Hi, everybody. I have an interview coming up in a minute with Jason Louv about his new book on John Dee. And I want to give you a heads up because this is, as far as I can remember, the most confrontational interview I've ever published on Skeptico. And I wanted to say two things about that. First, I'm okay with that. I'm okay with some heated exchanges and some disagreements, particularly in this case, because this guy has done a ton of interviews on this book, and the topics that we kind of clash over, I think most people would find surprising that he has such a strong opinion about scientism. I mean, he really believes in science as we know it and materialistic science. I mean, from a magic guy, that's super, super surprising. And the other thing is he's really down on conspiracies. I mean, he doesn't believe in conspiracies, whatever that means. And I guess that's the second thing that I want to bring up, because to me, that is such a litmus test. I know there's a lot of people out there that don't believe in conspiracies, but to me, you are on the outside of our culture, of our society, of this whole thing. You are on the outside looking in if you don't accept that conspiracies are at the heart of everything. They're at the heart of politics. They're at the heart of money. They're at the heart of, therefore, science, because science cares about all those things. Policy making, it's at the heart of everything. So, you know, to say I don't believe in conspiracies, and at the same time to say I believe in magic is, well, I wish I could have gotten there earlier in the interview, but he kind of surprised me with all that. But I think it's important. I think it's important to understand that and bring that forward, especially from a guy who's made such a splash with this book. So here then is my interview with Jason Louv. Welcome to Skeptico, where we explore controversial science and spirituality with leading thinkers, researchers, and their critics. Today, we welcome Jason Louv to Skeptico to talk about his new book, John Dee and the Empire of Angels, and all things magic and magical. Jason, welcome.
Thanks for having me on.
Well, it's a real pleasure to have you on. You know, I learned about you. I was listening to Greg Carlwood's show, which I like a lot. And then I was listening to Gordon White, who I really like. And he's been on the show a couple times. And I'm like, wow, how have I been missing the boat with Jason over here?
Yeah. Well, I've been missing an action for a while. I mean, I've been heavy pushing on magic since 2003. And 2005 was when my first book came out. So, you know, I've been in the trenches for a long, long time. But the newest book, I mean, I took 3 years off to write that book. So I've been out of the fray of the internet to prepare a small thermonuclear device. And sometimes when you're out of the fray of Twitter and Facebook and all that nonsense, people think you don't exist. So that's obviously not the case.
True enough. It doesn't take much for, out of sight, out of mind kind of thing. But you do have a lot of cool things going on, and a ton of people will be reintroduced to you through this book, and then they're going to find their way to your podcast. You're also a podcaster, Ultra Culture, and you have this cool course, a whole bunch of courses. I actually signed on for this course, which I'm showing on the screen here, Start Learning Magic. I mean, do give us the rundown on Jason, you know, where are you from? Brief bio, where are you from? What you're all about? How you got into all this stuff?
So I grew up in San Diego. I'm from Southern California. I was educated in the Bay Area and in London. I worked in the publishing industry and the advertising industry in New York and Los Angeles for most of my 20s. And I would describe myself as certainly as an author and as a futurist. I've written 8 books now. And I've been, you know, a lot of people talk about magic. I've been pretty steadily doing magic quietly and also publishing about it for my entire life for 20 years. That includes studying with traditions all over the world, including indigenous shamanism, Himalayan yoga, up in the Himalayas, masonry, neurolinguistic programming, Sufism, chaos magic, hermeticism, on and on and on and on. And sometimes I think that people should really do the work before they start talking on the internet. But, you know, I've been publishing books as well. And, you know, and for me, it's not just about spiritual development. I've tried to do everything that I can to do real magic in the world, which for me simply means trying to help the evolution of the human species. And some of the things I've done in that regard, I've worked with Buzz Aldrin on his plan to colonize Mars. I recently worked with Google's Artisan Machine Intelligence program on working with them on coming up with plans for benevolent superintelligence, because AIs will be happening very soon and it's imperative that they're friendly, as I'm sure you might imagine. And in the meantime, I've been, you know, trying to publish books on magic and teach courses on it and share my take on it and share my knowledge that I've, you know, the experience that I've gained with it, primarily because I think it's utterly imperative that, as we see every day now, that the human species, you know, gets to the next level here. We need to kind of move along and evolve beyond tribal warfare, which we seem to be sliding back into the Dark Ages. I would much rather humanity go forward into a glorious post-human, you know, enlightened Buddha-like future. So that's kind of the deal with what I've been up to. I'm probably leaving a lot out.
On the contrary, I mean, I think you've put almost too much to unpack there on the table, and I certainly want to try. And we're going to.
That's what I'll put on my tombstone: too much to unpack. They'll figure it out. They'll figure out what I've been up to in 150 years or something like that. Maybe they'll be upset, or maybe I'll just be forgotten.
In particular, when we add in this magical angle, because there's really, I think, one of the things I hope to do in this show is kind of give people a deep dive into the big picture questions, because you kind of blow past all these. But I'm tipping my hand in terms of where I want to go. Let's start with the book. Your publisher was nice enough to introduce me, so we are hereby obligated to talk about this really rather remarkable new book. It's getting a lot of attention, as well it should. It's really pretty fantastic. What I want to focus on here, I mean, tell people about the book. They should go out and get the book, even though we're not going to spend a lot of time in this interview talking about it. They should get it. Talk about what I've underlined there, Anakian magic, occult, and this empire architecture that is John Dee, and why he's relevant to anyone, whether they're super interested in magic or not.
Okay. So the book is called John Dee and the Empire of Angels, and it's a history and a biographical take on Dr. John Dee, who was Queen Elizabeth I's court astrologer and scientific advisor. He was a real life magician. He was interested in magic, and not just for, you know, silly things like fortune telling, but very directly to get the British Empire going. Dee was the guy who coined the phrase British Empire. He is the person responsible for laying out the naval schematics that made it possible to create, among many, many other scientific and mathematical achievements. He's the person that brought higher mathematics to the British public for the first time. And he also spent about 10 plus years doing occult rituals nonstop to talk to angels to try and learn the higher wisdom of humanity. Believe that or not, his work has had a tremendous impact on history, although it's been kept secret and occulted. So what that means is that this book is not just about the singular individual, but it's about the secret history of the last 500 years of the world, and about the occult forces that have been quietly yet, incredibly forcefully shaping world history. And what that really means is this is the guide to what reality actually is, and how to potentially reorient yourself to it, and maybe that you yourself might have to learn a bit of magic just to get your way out of the nightmare of history.
Okay, but he's also a complicated guy. As you are, you know, you're very fair-minded, I think, in the book. I mean, in some respects, he's a broken man. He's not a perfect man. The other thing is important is he's a Christian. You know, a lot of people will come across John Dee, and they'll immediately dive into the magic and the wife swapping and the crazy kind of stuff. And then, like, this guy is a devout Christian. He is as Christian as he can be. Even when he's doing his magic, he's praying intensely and intently to Jesus and to for protection and for guidance and all this stuff. But in the end, he also has this other side. He is a somewhat broken man. And then there is the question of, is he being manipulated somehow? So these are kind of the deeper questions, but the kind of stuff I did want to get into. So let's do that right now. What do you think?
Well, I push back on that a little bit in the sense that Dee certainly had some misadventures. He had ups and downs, but the reality is, I mean, the reality of John Dee is that he was a government servant. He was a not particularly well-paid one. But we have to put that in context. In context, nobody was well paid at this time. Sir Francis, you know, Dee spent his entire life in debt, but he wasn't unique in that. Sir Francis Walsingham, who started the British intelligence agencies at this time, also spent his life in debt. England was broke at this time, which Dee actually fixed by giving them the plans for building an empire and colonizing the New World. But also, we have to put that in context. And the reason that's important is so often people will point to stories of guys like John Dee or Crowley and say, well, oh, like they died broke, they died destitute. That proves that, you know, there's something sinister about magic and you shouldn't mess with it. Well, the reality is that John Dee rose to as high of a position as he could have given the economics of the time, given his class background. And look, I mean, it was the 1500s. Life was hard. People were dying of plague. You know, people were starving to death. You know, nobody.
Yeah,
nobody
but that's not what I'm referring to. What I'm referring to, and as you reveal in the book, I mean, I'm not putting the guy down because in one sense, he is the ultimate spiritual seeker, truth seeker, warrior. But, you know, the point where he almost reaches the point of suicide, I think, is telling in that it's telling in a couple of ways. One, he reaches it because his spiritual journey, he feels like, will not be fulfilled. Well, there's two ways to read that. One is to admire the kind of intense interest and desire he has to achieve this spiritual fulfillment. But the other is, you know, what's going on in the psyche of this guy that he's going to commit suicide? What goes on in the psyche of him when he pairs with Kelly, who is, you know, not that. So he is a complicated figure. Maybe you don't want to put broken on it, but I'm not talking about it in any other way than just as a, from the truth seeker, spiritual warrior part, he had a tough go of it.
Well, I think the bit you're referring to about the contemplation of suicide, so that was the late 1560s, or Dee had been attempting to contact angels and he couldn't do it. And he writes a comment in his diaries, which can be interpreted as him, you know, wanting to throw in the towel and contemplate suicide. But this was very passing. It wasn't a serious thing. And what happened is, that's when he realized he needed help. You know, I think there's often times in our life where we realize we can't do everything on our own. And that's when he started to audition scryers, because really what was happening there is that Dee was an intellectual. He was a hard head. He did not have any, what you might call intuitive or perhaps to go out on a limb, psychic faculties. So he couldn't go into trance states. But what he realized, and this was a really important realization for him, is that he needed to work with people that could. And that's when he met Kelly. And Kelly certainly brought baggage with him, but Kelly was incredibly talented and gifted. He could do it. So I don't think it's a surprise that they were working together. And I do think that, I don't think there's any time in Dee's life where you can say that he was broken. I mean, even towards the end of his life, he lost his wife and most of his children to the plague, yet he remained in good spirits to the very end, as is seen in his diaries. And I think that's a testament to the depth of his spiritual learning and his faith. You know, I mean, you know, life is hard when people go through hard things in their lives. It doesn't necessarily detract from their work. In fact, I don't think there's anyone on birth, particularly anyone who's ever achieved anything or tried to make some great scientific advance who hasn't gone through incredible hardships. I mean, if we look at some of the great scientists of the 20th century, like Marie Curie or Einstein, people like this, some of these people went through tremendous hardships in their life, but that doesn't necessarily mean that they were broken or detract from their, detract from how we view them. Life is hard.
You know, Jason, as I mentioned to you, I did sign up for and am in the middle of going through your free magic course. Very interesting stuff, very empowering in a lot of great ways. But I think one of the things that's going to throw people, as well as how your bio might throw people, what you're talking about a lot of times in terms of this empowerment, in terms of personal development, doesn't sound like magic in the way that a lot of people think of it. In a lot of ways, it doesn't even sound like the magic we encounter in the book in terms of what John Dee was thinking about in terms of magic, or what Kelly was thinking about in terms of magic. I've done a bunch of shows on this. So I've done a bunch of shows with Gordon. I've done a bunch of shows with other people who are getting into magic, like Dr. Dean Radin, the parapsychologist. I mean, how much do we have to own the fact that magic is usually associated with somehow marshaling this spiritual realm to do stuff on our behalf, and that is usually part and parcel of this definition of magic? So I'm all about the empowerment, the personal development stuff, but kind of help me sort through where we have to draw that line.
Sure. So what you're talking about is evocation, which is the conjuration of spirits. It tends to be associated with a Hollywood definition of magic, which doesn't really do us any favors, or the Hammer horror version of magic. My personal take on magic, and now having done it basically every day of my life for the last 20 years and studied under some of the greatest masters of it in the world, Genesis Peorage, gurus in the Himalayas, shamans in the Himalayas, Tibetan Buddhists, is the whole point of the magical path is enlightenment, right? So the point of magic is to develop yourself. Crowley refers to it as something along the lines of the absolute development of the whole man along the vertical axis. It's about becoming the ultimate version of yourself. And that's not just personal development. It's far beyond that. It is personal development, but it's much, much beyond that. Now, how to differentiate that from evocation? Here's my take on it.
Hold on, before you go there. Well, this is important too, because it's not just about evocation. It's not just about sorcery. It's about, look, you folks in the magical community have a really strong point to make, but I think you got to be clear about how you make it. One of the points you make that's really clear, crystal clear to anyone who wants to examine it, is if you're practicing religion, you're practicing magic.
Well, let's back up because I was about to finish my thought. I needed to respond to the first thing that you said before we get sidetracked, with all due respect. So the whole point about evocation, the reason that you asked me to draw a clear line, and I do this very clearly in the courses, and I do think that this is one thing that differentiates me quite a bit from other current teachers of magic. It's become quite in vogue within the last 10 to 20 years to look at grimoires and rely on grimoires and spirit conjuration. My personal take on this is that when you call up a spirit, conjure a spirit, or whatever you call that, to do something for you, what you're actually doing is missing the opportunity to develop the faculty to do it yourself. So my take on magic, and when I say magic, I use magic as a catch-all term for a lot of different spiritual paths, but specifically for the Western esoteric tradition. The point of the Western esoteric tradition is, as I said, the raising of the entire individual along the vertical axis of becoming a more enlightened, empowered, and awake individual. That's the safe way to do it. Conjuring spirits is the unsafe way to do it, by and large. Now, I'm not saying that to put down different traditions and religions that rely very strongly upon spirit contact, but that's not my interest in magic, and it's not what I teach. So,
well, I can accept that that's not what you teach or that that's not what your interest is. My problem is differentiating between the map and the territory. So you can say that, you know, that's not your map. That's not how you're doing it. Your map is personal empowerment or however you say it. The point is there a spiritual realm? And does that spiritual realm have impact on our material realm? And that is fundamentally the question that I think we wrestle with, and we don't wrestle to the ground. And we really need to wrestle to the ground as even just a basic starting point. You know,
right?
The screen that I put up here says reality. You know, this show is 90% about the fact that the absurdity that we live in a scientific reality that completely disavows, not only disavows, just doesn't acknowledge anything beyond materialistic, dogmatic kind of science, right? So there is no room for magic. There's no room for religion. There's no room for anything beyond that materialism that we're enmeshed in. And the absurdity is that no one really believes that. No one believes that they're a biological robot in a meaningless universe. We believe that we are able to connect with other people, that we have love, that we have meaning in our life. And yet we walk our kids to school and let them go into science class, and science class tells them, no, you are a biological robot and the universe is meaningless. So the first challenge, before we even get into any of that sorcery or evocation of spirits or any of that, is to understand the difference between this bracketed reality of science and spirituality, if you will, in its broadest sense, in terms of there being more than just a material world. Are we on the same page there or not?
Well, I can tell you my take on it, which is that when I approach these things, first off, I do not put science and magic in opposition to each other. I think that's a false dichotomy. And to be more specific about that, I think that science is the crowning achievement of humanity. I think it's the greatest tool we've ever come up with in order to, you know, put a light in the darkness, to light a light in the demon-haunted world, as Carl Sagan once called it. And I think that in this book, I really clearly shine a light on the work of people who were magicians and alchemists like John Dee and Giordano Bruno and Isaac Newton and Francis Bacon and people like that to create science. Science was a creation of the magical tradition, and it's a brilliant creation. Now, when I talk about magic, I'm very careful to separate these things, because the last thing that I want is for the scientific paradigm to collapse. Right now in America, we're seeing the catastrophic consequences of people not being able to know what's true anymore, and the whole thing of fake news and you know, things that are going on politically. We're really on the verge of going back to the dark ages. And so I'm very careful, even though I talk about magic, not to put up this kind of, you know, woolly 1970s In Search Of with Leonard Nimoy type of opposition between science and magic. And now that said, how are they different? So the way that I look at it is that science tells us the objective truths about what reality actually is. It's a brilliant tool. Magic is about the realm of subjectivity. It's the realm of how humans create meaning out of their experience. Now, are there quote unquote spirits? Is there a spiritual reality? There are absolutely things that people have perceived as spirits throughout all human history that have appear to have shaped history and certainly shaped people's lives on a day-to-day basis. The broader question is there any objective reality to that? Or is that just an aspect of people's minds? Perhaps a shared aspect of people's minds, like a collective unconscious, perhaps, to use an overused and a much abused term. That's the real question. What is that? The question of whether people interact with them and whether whether these things play a gigantic role in people's lives, that's a moot point, because that's the truth. That's what life on this planet is. Most cultures outside of Western culture interact with these realities on a daily basis, whether that's South America, Africa, India, Buddhist cultures, Thailand, even, you know, Christian groups, for the most part, are immersed constantly in the spiritual realm. Now, my previous answer, when I was saying the point of the way that I teach magic is that it's about enlightenment, is that for me, that was a magical answer. You know, as somebody who's interested in yoga and meditation, all of that is an intermediary layer. The part where people get obsessed with sorcery and spirits and powers and psychic phenomenon and all that stuff, that's kind of, people often call that the astral plane. And for me, that's an intermediary stage. That's something to get past. And what I'm interested in is enlightenment states. And to get to that, you have to get beyond that layer of whatever it is, that hallucinatory layer, because what happens as people get into meditation and magic is they get to unlock that hallucinatory layer, and it becomes endlessly fascinating, just like TV would be. But ultimately, it's a distraction at the end of the day, and that's another place where I have to distinguish what I'm teaching from a lot of other current approaches to magic. Are there spirits? Can you summon them? Yes. Can you do astral travel and all these things like this? Yes. Is it an intermediary stage? In my opinion, yeah.
So here's the hard part, Jason.
Mm-hmm.
I totally agree with you in the end game. So I'm a yogi, right? So that's my orientation. Okay.
Great. What type of yoga?
Forget that. My problem with the magical community.
It's kind of important, but okay.
Well, it's important to me, right? It's not important to this conversation right now.
The reason I say it's important is because I'm trying to tell what your focus is, if you're, what you're focusing on with your practice.
Well, what I'm focusing on right now is I don't understand how you are fully embracing materialistic science and not drawing a, I don't get that. You know,
why
I don't
not?
Get the because we are, science has systematically and quite intentionally tried to deny all the aspects of the greater self that you're talking about. It's not an accident. It's not this miracle of science kind of thing. It's part of that, but it's also culture shaping in terms of telling us that you are not more. You are just a biological robot. Go out and shop. Satisfy your physical desires, because that's all you are. And I'm kind of...
Science doesn't say go out and shop. That's consumerism and advertising.
How do you understand the distinction between scientific materialism and the consumeristic materialism? Where do you think that line is drawn philosophically?
Well, those are two totally different things.
No, they're not totally different things. Yes,
they're absolutely different. No. You're overgeneralizing, with all due respect. You're conflating a lot of different things. So let's back up to the beginning. So first of all, with scientific materialism, to paint the entirety of hundreds of years of science with one brush and say that it has a unified dogma is just inaccurate.
What unified dogma are you talking about?
Well, what you just said, exactly what you just said, where you said
materialistic science, by definition, says that science is matter and that we can measure what is going on and what we experience, right? Isn't that fundamentally what we call materialistic science? Isn't that definition of materialism?
That's one general part of thinking of science, but science evolves constantly. One thing that I've shown in John Dee and the Empire of Angels is if you go back to the beginnings of science, and people like John Dee and Francis Bacon and Isaac Newton, is those things were never separate. And increasingly now they're not separate. We see people like Rupert Sheldrake or Dean Radin, you mentioned, people who are looking at these things very seriously. But science is not a dogma. Science is simply a set of techniques. And to discard it, well, that's absolutely true. I'm sorry. To discard it would be like going back to the Dark Ages. I'm assuming you're alive right now because you've had access to penicillin. You've had access to drugs and things that have been produced by science that have given you we're talking on this computer. All of these things have been given to us. And I really don't draw a distinction. Science is an amazing tool. Humanity has created many, many different wonderful tools. Why would we refuse to use them? I mean, if you want to go back and live in a cave in the 12th century, go right ahead. But you seem not to be doing that because we're having a conversation on Zoom. So you must like science a bit. You're certainly benefiting from it. Now, in terms of whether science denies certain parts of the spiritual realm, I have two answers to that. One answer is that's good to a large extent. you look at certain parts in this world where people are still immersed in fear, fear of people having magical power over them. That's no good. But also, everything is a process. Everything is a process of change. Science has been a very important period for human consciousness to evolve through.
How does science as we know it, modern science, understand human consciousness?
Well, it doesn't fully, but that doesn't mean that it doesn't have the answer. And that's where you get people like me coming along.
What is the current position of science on human consciousness? That it's an epiphenomena of the brain. That is it, plain and simple.
Well, I think that's evolving quite a bit. I mean, right now, so I've done quite a bit of work on artificial intelligence.
That's not true. Hold on, it's not true. So you can say it's evolving, but it's evolving from the position. It's clearly not true.
Guy, I've agreed to this interview, so please at least let me finish my answers.
It's a conversation, so we can talk.
Okay, so let's talk one at a time. And I'll do research.
So you interrupted me, but go ahead.
Okay, I won't. All right, so I've done a lot of work on artificial intelligence. Science doesn't have an answer.
I was in the PhD program in artificial intelligence at University of Arizona. I know all about it. Go ahead.
So they don't fully know, but that doesn't mean that there's not an answer. They're trying to reduce consciousness to an algorithm. Personally, I don't think they actually will. And what I want to make it very clear that I'm not saying that science has the ultimate answers. What I'm saying is that science is a process. It's very hard to define because the very point of science is that hypotheses are made and then tested. And that's an ongoing process and things are overturned. We don't fully know. And certainly in my work, what I'm trying to do is bring interest in things like meditation and spirituality. And I want people to look at them. I particularly want scientists to look at them and in an empirical and methodical way so that we can look at those parts of the human experience and bring back things that can be helpful to our further evolution as a species, particularly because our technology is advancing so quickly that we haven't been able to catch up with it on the wisdom front. So again, everything's a tool. I look at things magically in the sense that everything's a tool, and I think we should use all of it.
Yeah, I just think we have to nail some things down. So when you say consciousness, you know, I talk to these folks all the time. I'm some of the leading researchers on consciousness, both on the materialistic side and more of the cutting edge side. You know, Dean Radin's been on the show many times. Rupert Sheldrick has been on the show many times, as has Christoph Koch, you know, one of the leading researchers, or who's the guy at Arizona, Hameroff, you know, the guy who's more. So I'm familiar with this. I just don't think you're really fairly representing the struggle between this materialistic definition of consciousness that is an epiphenomenon of the brain and how science as we know it has just vehemently denied even considering all the data that contradicts that, all the data from near-death experience science, but even going back to quantum physics. Quantum physics is really puts a wrench in the whole idea of this consciousness being an epiphenomenon of the brain. This is a huge, not only a dilemma for science, but it's a huge stumbling block for science. So, you know, you don't have to tell me science is a method. It's not a position statement. Of course, we all get that. But the reality is the way science operates inside our society, the way it works in terms of shaping policy, the way it works in terms of shaping culture, it's really important that we understand these. Now, I don't understand the cheerleading for science as we know it. I mean, I guess I'm more of an iconoclast, but I think there has to be, for us to move forward, I think it's really important that we have some fundamental reality check on just what consciousness is and how much our current understanding of consciousness goes against what is accepted widely throughout academia as being human consciousness. So,
right.
You understand my frustration.
Well, I think this is hilarious because now you got the magic guy arguing for science on.
I know what's going on.
Skeptico. Well, look, here's the thing. Okay. Is there a friction between science's current definition of consciousness and what mystics have been telling us for a long period of time? Yes. Is science to a large degree run by defense and military contracting? Yes. Is that a problem? Yes. What I don't want to do is make a monolithic statement for all science as if all science is somehow some gigantic can be represented with one statement, because that's simply not true. There's scientists all over the world working on all different projects. And to speak of that there's one monolithic scientific establishment is simply not true. It's just sloppy thinking. So
of course not, but it's sloppy thinking to say it the other way too.
No, it's not. No, it's not. What I'm saying is what we're doing in general as a culture is we're increasing our knowledge. Science is one of our tools to do that. Mysticism is another. To go backwards, to reject science and to go backwards would be a tremendous civilizational-wide disaster. And we see the consequences of that type of thinking in our world right now, with people accepting conspiracy theories, fake news, anti-vaccination stuff. It's an utter nightmare. All you have to do is go on Facebook.
Yes. So let's bring into this conversation your friend and mine, Gordon White, right? And I always credit Gordon with an important insight that he gave me in this, is that when I rail against the monolithic science as we know its stand on human consciousness and how just bizarre it is that academia promotes this, because you're right, there are the outliers, right? And I've interviewed plenty of them on this show, inside of academia, who point out the absurdity of this. Say, well, look, I mean, you know, Schrodinger and the other giants of quantum physics, they got it 100 years ago. They said, clearly this materialistic science doesn't make any sense. We have to look beyond that. So clearly there's been these giants within science who've tried to light the path in another direction, yet we keep going down this brain dead position, this brain dead path. Why? And here was Gordon's point. He said,
define brain dead. Go back up.
Finish the story. You'll like this story. It's Gordon's insight, and I think it's a good one.
Well, that's another sloppy generalization, but okay, go ahead.
Well,
what do you mean by brain dead? Like, what does that mean?
Okay. I'm going to just breeze right past it. Here's
the point. Okay, you're bringing up things that just don't make sense. What does brain dead mean? You're talking about all science and it's brain dead. What does that mean? Like, define it to me, because I don't understand what you mean.
It's a figure of speech, Jason.
What are you trying to figure? What are you trying to tell me? What are you trying to communicate to me? No, it's important.
You're the one who said we weren't going to do the interruption game. So, you know, the jabbing back and forth, it's not even going to make good theater, let alone communicate any ideas.
But I'm just trying to understand what you're saying.
I think you do understand what you're saying. You're being coy.
I understand what I'm saying.
When I say brain dead science, what's difficult about that to understand? After I've said a million times. Hold on.
It's not true.
You said you were going to interrupt.
Well, right? You just asked me a question.
You weren't going to interrupt, right?
But you asked me a question and I responded.
Well, you're still interrupting, right? So you don't want to play
question.
This game. You want to play
Ask
this
your question.
Game. That's okay. So
no, you asked me a question and I responded. Okay, here's my point.
Let me finish the story.
Science is not brain dead. That's silliness. I'm sorry. That's silliness.
Well, okay. It's a figure of speech. It's an exaggeration. Okay. All right. No one thinks that science is completely brain dead. Brain dead isn't.
Okay, good. We're agreed. Okay. We're agreed. So you said something that is not true.
No, I said something. No,
you just said it. Can't be interpreted literally. Okay.
Yes.
Carry on.
Exactly.
Carry on.
Which you knew all along, but you wasted 2 minutes of the show to.
No. Hey, look, man. Okay, look. I got a ton of stuff to do, so please just tell me what your point is.
Well, I mean, I don't know that's going to make any difference. It's like you said, I don't understand how a magic guy gets in. You know, you're non-conspiratorial. So where I was going to go down is the conspiratorial path, right? So for you don't want to hear that, but to suggest that the government control mechanism, CIA, deep state, however you want to put it, hasn't had a vested interest in steering consciousness in a certain way in terms of steering academia towards this materialistic science that denies a larger, broader, extended consciousness, while at the same time they were investigating and figuring out how to weaponize consciousness, I think is incredibly naive. And I don't see it in your worldview at all. It just seems...
Well, that's because I don't agree with it.
You don't agree with it?
Well, let me ask you this. If that's true,
you
then why has...
You don't history then.
No. If that's true, then why has the Trump administration been defunding science and denying science left and right? If anything, the people in power want to deny climate science. Trump. Science, here's my position, okay? Science
What's
is...
What's your position on climate change?
No. Back up. Here's my position. Science is the greatest light that humanity has ever created. You ask me, how can a magic person say that? I'm a human being.
I didn't ask you that question.
Guy. Listen to me.
I didn't ask you that question.
You just did.
I didn't ask.
Please, you're interviewing me. Let me speak.
Go back.
If you
and
want to interview me,
go
let
back
me
and
speak.
Review the thing. You interrupted me like a million times. So now you can explain.
Do you believe in climate change? Do you think climate change is supported by the science? Listen to me. Do you think science supports climate change? Yes, 99.7% of all NASA scientists. Okay.
That's the most fake figure in the world. You're an idiot.
I'm sorry. You don't believe in climate science? NASA. Go to the NASA website.
This is
what is driving our world back to the dark ages. This type of thinking. Conspiratorial. If that was actually true, the government would be funding all this science, but they're actually tearing it apart. And what's happening is the world is sliding backwards into ignorance of the type that you're displaying.
Because if you're going to be global warming,
look, if you're going to be an individual who wants to liberate humanity, you will use every tool possible. Robert Anton Wilson, one of my heroes, thought that you should be able to wear every hat possible, whether that's magic or science or consciousness, and you should be able to go back and forth between them as much as possible. With people like you, I push science. With people who are hard science people, I push consciousness. But right now, you're just telling me things that are not true, and you're being very combative about it. And I'm being combative back because I'm pushing back against statements which are just simply not true. This is important because we live in a post-truth world, which actually means a world full of lies and delusions, misinformation, and uneducation.
Have you ever read the study from the NASA that's cited on the NASA website and that was cited by Obama, the 97% consensus? Have you ever read the study? Do you know the methodology that was used?
You haven't even said the name of the study.
Well, it's the same study that everybody references. I forget the guy's name, but do you know?
You haven't told me what the name of what the study is, what or even what it says.
I'll tell you what it says, but the methodology, which everyone assumes that they went out and they polled scientists and they asked them what their view on global warming is. But that's not the methodology that they used. What they did is they hired a bunch of grad students to survey science abstracts. And then they made a judgment call on whether those abstracts were supportive or non-supportive of their understanding of what global warming was. It was flawed from the beginning. And then in particular, many, many scientists came forward who were cited in that study and said, hey, my paper said the exact opposite of that, and yet I was put in this category. So if you want to go look at the work of people like... what's her name at Georgia Tech? I can't think of her name right now. I'm happy to cite that to you. But many people have pulled that apart. It's just a ridiculous study. It's the pure example.
Honestly, I'm gonna trust NASA, the NASA website, and the scientific consensus on this, which is really non-negotiable. Then somebody being an idiot in this conversation, and frankly, I feel like I'm in the comments section of a Facebook discussion.
I can pull up that study if you want to look at it. I can send it to
please
you.
Please send it to me. We're out of time, but please go ahead and send it to me. The reality
vaccine,
of climate change
vaccines,
is not
I'd love
negotiable.
To hear your take on vaccines.
Oh, for Christ's sake. Oh, for Christ's sake.
Yeah. Great.
Here's my point. Human, the liberty.
The name calling. The name calling, Jason. The name
human,
calling.
Human. Guy. Good guy.
Not good
guy. Guy.
Not
guy.
Good
I don't, look. the liberty of human consciousness is at stake right now. Humanity going back to the dark ages for opinions like this. That's my point. Anybody who is listening to this conversation, I highly recommend there's an audio series called Your Deceptive Mind by Dr. Stephen Novella, which will go systematically.
Oh my gosh. Why didn't you say you were a Steve Novella fan at the beginning? We could have short-circuited this whole thing.
What's wrong with that?
I got 3 or 4 interviews with Steve Novella. I mean,
he's great.
He's great. So this interview obviously is a train wreck, and I've held off from jumping in and making any comments, but I did have to jump in here because inside baseball can only go so far, and we're talking about Steve Novella, and I realize a lot of people might not know who Dr. Stephen Novella is, and who he is a Yale University neurologist and one of the best-known public skeptics. I mean, hardcore skeptic. He does this show, The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, and everything to this guy is, you know, what they call woo. You know, those hardcore skeptics is woo. Spirits, total woo. I mean, it isn't at all within his belief system. Occult, magic. Heck, this guy doesn't believe in free will. He doesn't believe in consciousness. You know, I always say the biological robot, meaningless universe. His worldview demands that everything about your minute-by-minute experience of consciousness is purely the product of your brain. Therefore, there is no such thing as meaning. There is no such thing as love, connection, all that stuff. And he doesn't even believe in parapsychology. I mean, the debates that I've had with him have been about, like, Dean Radin's carefully controlled, multiply replicated presentiment work. Completely denies it, completely misrepresents it, and then, you know, says that that Radin fiddles with the data. The worst of the worst in terms of hardcore skeptics. And this is, I mean, it makes no sense to me, Jason. It's the self-loathing thing, you know, like, let's cozy up with these people that completely hate and stand against everything we're about. Man, I don't get that. He's great. Go back and listen to my interviews with him. I think he doesn't hold up very well. And I don't think you've held up very well either. But then,
well, you've just been a laughing monkey.
We'll let the listeners decide. Awesome.
The light of science, intelligence. Let there be light, fiat lux, as both the scientists and the alchemists have said. Humanity must be liberated from superstition by knowledge.
What does Novella think of your magic?
Oh, he would totally discount it, but I love to talk about it with him. But like I said, I'm willing to shift hats. If I'm having this conversation, I can wear the skeptic hat. On Skeptico, I've out-skeptic the Skeptico podcast.
Well, you don't understand what Skeptico is about. I encourage you to get Novella on your show. That's one I would listen to. You haven't. Sure. So I've spoken with him. I've faced off with him several times. You haven't. So
I'm sure that went great. I'm sure he loved you.
Hey, I think we had a mutual respect. That's why we did multiple shows, but that's okay. You know what? A lot was revealed. I always learn something. Thanks for coming on.
All right. Thank you for having me.
Thanks again to Jason Liu for joining me on Skeptico. I do have to say thanks. Like I said at the end, I do always learn something, even sometimes something that I don't expect to learn. So one question I'd have to tee up from this interview: what do you make of Jason's chaos, magic, scientism, science as we know it connection? Am I exaggerating that, or is he maybe have a point in terms of we're all wrestling with how to understand science in a magic world? So how do we resolve those two? Let me know your thoughts. Of course, the place to do it is through the Skeptico website, comment, Skeptico forum, Facebook, email, any way you like. Have a number of interesting shows coming up. Do stay with me for all of that. Check out the website for all the shows available for free. Until next time, Take care, and bye for now.